Gary.
Yes, I've got actually three things, one for each of you. The one for you, Barry, is just a thing that I win the prize for the most recent band encounter. I met Phil Lesh, as some of you guys, as I keep telling you, in the security line at the Oakland airport yesterday.
Oh, for heaven's sake, really?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Talked to him very briefly. No, I didn't. People keep asking me that. I didn't want to bother him. I just thanked him and shook his hand. The one for Liz is more a comment than a question. I was struck as you were talking about, and you talked a lot about the contemporary or current jam band scene, and yet I was struck that almost all of your examples were Phish and examples from the mid to late 90s. And it made me wonder how things have changed since then, because that's in fact no longer contemporary. So there's a time jump in this.
I had a couple of comments that I wanted to add that aren't directly related to that about the way the jam band scene has evolved in the last few years that I think are indicative of sort of some of the values that formed to begin with, specifically about one thing that each of you talked about, both taping and jam band tourism. Taping, first, something that I found interesting is that some of the more recent bands, the Disco Biscuits and Sector 9 are the ones that jump to mind, have been recently selling a lot, basically taping all of their shows and selling them and then specifically discouraging people from trading them in order to buy them. And I think that's, and the other point is related to that.
Of course, those are all soundboards.
They're all soundboards, again, yeah. But
they do still encourage the audience taping.
That's so true, though. Audience taping has shrunk immeasurably over the last few years.
And you can do it either, like you can do it online through the band, or right. I know Umphrey's, you can get the disc right after the show.
The reason it's so interesting to me is because taping for me was such a huge do-it-yourself part of the jam band scene and the Phish scene, and to me the idea that it's turning into another product, and that's interesting, and it's perfectly valid for the bands to be doing it. I can't really be upset for the bands to be making money off their own music. But
the most important thing about that is that it's getting harder and harder for them to make a living.
Well, no, component of it. I mean, I'm not sort of criticizing.
I was just going to say something that why I have a tendency to shy away from notions of like community and things like that. I originally started doing research that dealt with internet sites and how things were discussed on internet sites, but the fact that everything's digital now, and you know, you can just go and rip a BitTorrent file. You don't need to know anybody there. It's and you can. It changes this sense of community or culture that's really working against the system.
I don't think it necessarily just destroys the community.
No, it alters, and that's why I'm more apt to talk about scene and things like that, because it addresses some sort of fluidity. But
and the other point that I wanted to make was, which is also related to things that used to sort of be do-it-yourself and that are now kind of ossifying into packages, are first there was the String Cheese doing their sort of travel agency, but also things like Jam Cruise. And then there's this new company, there's a profile of them in the current front page of jambands.com, which is basically a first-class jam band tour package thing, where you buy this package and you get hotel, travel, tickets to the show, they deal with everything. And there's something that, I mean, again, I understand the impulse, it's safe travel, it's a lot of things, but there's something kind of stomach-turning to me about that. I talked to my dad before I came out here yesterday, and he's like, oh, so you're renting a car, what are you doing? I'm like, I don't know, go to the hotel and find the heads and figure out what the hell's going on then. And to me, the idea of like buying a package and like knowing exactly what you're going to be doing at every time, just, I don't know.
Where's the sense of adventure?
Exactly. My
third question is for Chris, and it was actually a question that came up for me in Kay's talk earlier as well. It has to do with Rastafarianism and the roots of reggae in Rasta. And the way the scene that you were talking about draws upon that. And what struck me both times is that Rastafarianism and the Rasta movement within reggae, as I understand it, really only tells part of the story. Mm-hmm. And the other part of the story is the Rude Boy scene.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is just as authentic as the Rasta scene, if we believe in such a thing as authenticity, which I don't particularly, but so I wondered if there are any aspects of the Rude Boy scene, what you're going to do when they come for you, whatever, that have carried over into these current jam band scenes.
You know what? I've read a lot about Rastafarianism, and I'm unfortunately am ignorant of Rude Boys because I've read all the stuff on Rastafarianism, and it's never been mentioned.
It does not center around spirituality at all. It centers around guns. It was a very, very violent scene. Street shootings.
5446 is my number.
Yeah, 5446 is my number. The Harder They Come. There are several songs in the movie, The Harder They Come, that are directly
the gangster and western movies. Mm-hmm. They're very close.
Yeah, it's a kind of gangster scene. A very gun-focused gangster, violent gangster.
Rudy's Looking for a Fight.
Rudy's Looking for a Fight is another great example. Okay. And in reggae, there have always been these two strands going along, sort of as the yin and yang, to put it in a slightly silly way, of that scene. And certainly over the, I don't know that much about the more recent reggae scene, but what I have seen of it is that the Rude Boy aspect of it has emerged much more strongly over the last 20 years or so, at least like the dance hall movement. A much less spiritual scene and a much more, instead of ganja, it's cocaine
the rising reputation of Jimmy Cliff over Bob Marley, for example. It's still pretty violent. I mean, he got shot.
Yeah.
Well, come on, the climactic scene in The Harder They Come is don't fuck with me.
So I guess kind of posing that as a suggestion, that might be something
I need to look at that.
To examine.
Thank you.
The reggae scene is not nearly as kind of uniform.
Without the person of Bob Marley and his charisma and his ability as a human being to unify those things, would it even have happened?
Yeah.
Could anyone else have accomplished that? I think not.
Yeah, I agree with that.
What do you think?
I agree with that. Because when I go to shows and I hear reggae, it's Bob Marley. I don't hear anything else. That's the posters, the tapestries, the blankets. It's his image.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, I was going to ask that when you were saying, you know, listening to Rasta music, how much of it is actually listening to Rasta, or is it just...
Yeah, it's Bob Marley. Or Peter Tosh.
Or it's just a soundtrack for Possible.
Well, to be fair, a lot of this sort of the newer jam bands have started being pretty heavily influenced by dub and sort of... that generation of reggae, which has been kind of one of the more interesting musical developments in the art.
Yeah. You mentioned the image of Bob Marley, because I think there you have to look at like the Jerry Garcia icon face, you know, Bob Marley, Shakespeare. You know, there's certain figures that went past their immediate culture and became almost universal icons. So yeah, I think a lot of people, they're not necessarily making a deep historical study of reggae and rocksteady and ska and stuff like that. They're kind of just going towards the cult of Bob Marley.
I have just a couple quick things to say, but one being that this idea of the pastiche of styles that you talked about. I know that Frederick Jameson talks about the difference between parody and pastiche.
Mm-hmm.
Very simply put,
parody
is self-conscious of the norms that they are parodying and is specifically different from that, whereas pastiche does not realize that they're parodying, that they're imitating something different, and therefore there's no humor, and that's what makes it so wonderfully postmodern and kitschy.
Yeah, exactly.
And that I was thinking of when you were talking about Maki Super Policeman. I was thinking of another Fish song, NICU, which is a ska beat. It's very much a ska song, and the lyrics are just weird and twisted. I mean, there's this whole, you know...
Don't turn left,
There's this whole idea of kind of detachment and the malaise of life. There's the line, nice evening at home that I dread even more, you know, and things like that. So this idea, that they're consciously kind of humorizing the borrowings that they're making. Mm-hmm. So musically, that's one thing.
So Jake, what would you call a consciously multi-referential, like Hunter would do?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at I Wish I Was a Headlight on a Northbound Train, you've got the Underground Railroad, you've got 400 years of first forced conversion of African slaves, and you've got the first 18 chapters of Exodus. So what, if that's a knowing...
Of course, that's not Hunter.
oh, whoever the hell it was. Sorry, you're right. You're right. It's wrong. If you look at that, it's not pastiche by your definition. What would you call it?
That'd be parrot.
Wait, where did it ever? Whoever said that he was singing about that?
I mean, that's just the one definition of pastiche and parody that I've read recently that pops in my head.
So then, Ramble on Rose with all of those different allusions would be parody.
It would be parody as well, because I think that by that particular definition, and these are not the I think that we should be clear that these are not the conventional definitions of parody and pastiche that we use.
Yeah, but that would certainly challenge them if you were saying that they were.
Right.
So that's what I'm asking.
No,
like,
it's not. It's a
definition. That's
not
how you're using it.
It's translated from the French.
Allusions are not charity.
It's a mimetic style that Jameson has called parody.
Thank you. I just needed to
understand. And then the other quick thing I wanted to say to Liz was just that I was kind of concerned with your generalization of jam bands and contemporary jam band culture.
Well, I should say, in the grand scheme, I'm looking at an immediate post-2000. So
right.
I use contemporary in the sense that I'm not talking about specifically what is happening in 2007. I use it in a comparison way to what I am talking about when I refer back to the late 60s and early 70s.
I think it is interesting, though, that one unifying characteristic of fans of Yonder Mountain String Band and fans of the Disco Biscuits is that more often than not, they also like the band. And that is, in that way, the Grateful Dead is, and Deadheads in general are that kind of borrowed subculture as well for each of them, but they're not necessarily borrowing things from each other. You know, I don't think that there's necessarily that much in the Yonder scene that is concurrent with what's going on in the Disco Biscuit scene at all the same time.
No, so I wasn't arguing that. I was arguing that pretty much all of these people in the, we'll say, contemporary scene, there are people, members of that scene and band members that are making connections with specifically the Dead scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has a lot to do with the way that is remembered and that gets circulated.
The metaphor that works for me is refraction, that there's some Dead thing. The Dead themselves were a jumble of many things, some of them self-contradictory, but that it seems to be like a lot of these post-Dead bands, sort of, it's almost like that beam was split in a thousand different ways, and you get kind of shards of it, or you get like one idea taken to a conclusion, but
wow,
other things kind of dropped along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Except for bands.
Well, Rat Dog, I think, I would think of Rat Dog as something different because it comes from a member of the Dead, and that's a, it is a refraction. The diaspora thing definitely was happening there, too. And you know 10 times as much about Rat Dog than I do, but Rat Dog was started as the Rat Dog Review, the sort of, you know, kind of casual pickup side thing for Bobby to do, and inadvertently it was promoted into his main vehicle, you know, by circumstances. But yeah, I think I think if you then say, well, it's a choice for those kinds of fans about what music to go follow or dance to or whatever, then yeah, it would be part of that same refractory kind of splitting off, I think.
I feel like a lot of that same spirit is at Rat Dog shows, except now it's all about beer.
Yeah.
Instead of
not the truth.
Rat Dog.
Rat Dog. Yes.
Is
that Gen X? Forgive me.
If you go back and you look at the Grateful Dead movie, which I did not long ago, I don't think they sold beer inside Winterland. And
what are those guys drinking?
Yeah.
What? Who drinks?
In the bar.
There's an interview where the guy is saying,
I guess maybe they were.
They were
20 years.
Actually, but it was not the same as.
It wasn't an alcohol thing.
Yeah,
we were like anti-alcohol.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
People come down to the front.
Okay.
They drink and they talk downstairs.
This is
not fair.
Have you found any difference in your research between the use of drug use of older jam band fans and younger? You said that The older ones tend to use it for mind expansion. What I see when I go to Bonnaroo and things like that is that younger people seem to be using them just to get themselves
numb. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that something that you have also
observed? Yeah, I observed that too. I feel that there's a lot of clingers on, I feel, to the scene that are like, I'm going to find drugs and I'm just going to get wasted. Mm-hmm. You know, and if I happen to pick up a free ticket, okay, cool, I'll go see the show.
And would you relate that to the phenomenon of what we would call touch heads in the Grateful Dead scene? People who came in right around the band's first hit in 1986, basically to stand in the lot and get drunk and maybe go into the show.
Right, we call them Wookiees.
Well, yeah, Wookiees are something else.
Wooks are something else.
They're something else.
Okay,
yeah.
So.
They're the permanent, the permanent road
dirt
people
surfers.
Who have no aspirations to be anything else. The people who live under bridges in Golden Gate, who live under trees in Golden Gate Park, that people like that. That's what the deadheads I know call Wookiees.
The modern Wookiee is just someone who's kind of dirty because they probably haven't showered in a few days because they haven't been not taking drugs for a few days and they're just in the lot. But
like contested meeting.
But they might.
Yeah.
They might have a job. Or
yeah, whenever we see a Wook, the first thing we say to him is, get a job.
Well, we've also just started calling people who are, even if they're clean cut or whatnot, it's kind of there's an attempt to just call people Wooks because, because they're
so bad,
they,
so
they
that
drink.
There's a website, and
oh,
I don't know if anybody remembers, I don't know, Jesse, if you remember when Fish came back in 2003 and did the New Year's run, they had a website with number 17. Do you remember number? Do you have a number 17 scene? Like people, he was all over the internet. Like I sat in a cab with him in Vegas, and I was like, number 17 was right next to me in Vegas.
17 as a posse. there's this. It's still up for people with open Wi-Fi connections right now. PassedOutWooks.com, or it might be .org, which is just people posting pictures of of Wooks passed out.
Oh, really?
But it's not surrounded. But it could just be somebody who like.
Basically, anybody who passes out is therefore a Wook.
Right.
It's that kind of definition. Right. There's also another term that's sort of been circulating, which is custies, which I think.
Oh,
yeah.
Custies.
Yeah,
where do puppy pullers fit in?
Custies are not Wooks.
Well, right now, custies are sort of opposed to Wooks, but custies are kind of amateur hour. That sort of
thing. They want me to get a cookie. They want me to set a cookie. Ask Custy's
Wooks.
There's an interesting sort of connection that sort of carries the conversation about Wookiees all the way back to what y'all were doing, Chris and Liz, which is that one comment was that when I first encountered the term Wookiee, it was in California.
They're not in those sessions start till 2015.
Second generation back to the land folks. They came out from extremely rural Northern California. They were characterized by just massive amounts of hair, and they were always very proud of the fact that number one they were off the grid, and number two they had not been weed ever. And they were that was my introduction to the term Wookiee. I had never actually encountered it as a cultural term. Now here's the connection back to what Charlie was talking about earlier. The thing that I kept on thinking about. Notice how the term Wookiee means so many different things to different people. The sub-theme that I thought really was interesting in both y'all's paper is the way we're getting at the sort of immensely complex ways that cultural memory get transferred, not just between generations, but for very long periods of time, over centuries. And the Western tradition of the Bohemian, which is hotly contested and still a vastly disparate and complex literature. But one of the things I wanted to ask both of y'all about, this is a book that irritates me no end, but nonetheless I can't dismiss it. Do y'all know Gil Marcus's Lipstick Traces?
Sure.
It's a fascinating, he basically outlines what's, he basically has this, and I'll steal from what I'm going to talk about tomorrow with Dr. Krippner in Postmodern Science. He's got basically sort of a postmodern notion of this is something that I can't really define or measure, but I am going to try to describe it. And that was one of the things that I was kind of thinking really kind of unifies both of y'all's work and is, and boy, hats off to you for tackling it because that's about as hard of going as I can imagine right now. But anyway, sorry, that was actually more of a peroration than a serious question. I promise I did have a question in there, but I got lost in the thickets of explication. But Well, actually, maybe the question was merely, have y'all encountered lipstick traces and has it had an impact
there you go.
On you?
I have not.
Okay.
I've heard the title.
Steve?
It's a quick read, tragically.
It is a quick read.
quick read? Define quick. It's a book about that ties in the punk movement with the French Situationists. It's by equal measures annoying as hell and fascinating.
Okay.
And he's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, looks like
that. Okay, Steve.
Question for
there they are.
Yep.
Half that works.
I gotta follow that.
Remember the bunny we used to always have at festivals? Festival was that? They had advertisements on the radio.
What was that?
Was that it?
Mm-hmm.
Because then they did the bunny.
One for Chris, one for Liz. For Chris, I think it was fascinating that in the beginning you set up the notion of a subculture as something which shocks the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
And now if you look at these subcultures, in essence, what they're pulling from is from the generation that now basically is the
mainstream. Yeah.
Which means they're not shocking at all. In fact, the mainstream is saying, you're nowhere near as shocking as I was when I was there. Which raises the question of irony and the role of irony in defining the culture. And when you go back to the cartoons, and when you go back to these things, what role is irony playing? And for Liz, you know, you used a wonderful phrase that cultural memory represents a battlefield. And when you think of cultural memory, you think of battlefield. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to Gettysburg.
Maybe. Just 4 years of my life.
In Gettysburg, there is actually a huge group of people who are trying to relive the 60s. It just happens to be the
1860s. Oh, yeah.
And I'd be fascinated to hear your reflection on the difference between the Civil War folks and the jam band. I mean, is it the same sort of trying to reconstruct a memory and relive something they weren't? Is there something different?
I don't know. I think it gets real hairy when you get into Civil War reconstructors. I don't know exactly what baby goes. I haven't read anything about the reenactors in Gettysburg, but I've done a lot. I mean, I got my master's at Alabama, so I was kind of stuck in a hole where Tuscaloosa and Roll Tide. And so a lot of the stuff that I did with cultural memory, my first real introduction to it, was done via Southern studies. So the Lost Cause, all those notions came up, and I would maybe say that I don't think it's... There is a part of identifying with something that you're not and being able to position yourself. There's a lot of political activism that goes on to the Reconstruction and reliving it in the South. I've done some work on the reappropriations of the Confederate flag and how that's done by white Southerners and African-American groups that have changed the colors of the flag and have done, like, New South. And so I think there's something with trying to subjectively be able to alter some your own positioning and in turn your own identity and the way that you see yourself. And I mean, memory is all, it's all contingent upon the politics of the present, and so is history. So it gets, that's to me what's so interesting about it. So I think there's some parallels between them. I don't know, it's Confederates in the Attic. It's a great book as far as looking at connections.
I'm always fascinated by the use of terms. I really like the way you're using the word scene to narrow things out. And people always say, the deadheads of the 60s. Well, you know, deadhead microculture really started in the 80s, the very beginning of the 80s. And we're not touring, caravanning people in the 60s. And then you have subculture. You can take, you know, Chinese-American contemporary culture, which is not disaffected with the mainstream, that they're trying to, you know, get the best education possible. And then you have that big hairy thing called the counterculture, which was called the movement, but it had about 9 different movements, if not more, at the same time. And boy, I'd sure love to see the evolution where those terms are a little bit more clearly defined, because subculture, counterculture implies a disaffection, whether you're a black power activist or whatever. So. And it's interesting. I really like the way you use scene and differentiating, narrowing it down as we're splintering as Christians.
And now there's deadheads who never saw the Grateful Dead.
Yep.
Right.
Ding. I'm sorry.
That's me.
The question that I just personally never got to the bottom of this term jam band. I personally never liked it, and sort of actually, you know, being involved with a lot of different music, the jazz world and so forth, and having friends jazz musicians and so forth, I've kind of come to find in the larger scope of the music world, jam band is kind of a smear term in terms of musicians. And I tell people sometimes that the term jam band didn't even exist when the Grateful Dead was playing music. And I don't know if that's true or not.
It is true.
It is true, yeah.
I don't know.
Dean Budnick.
Yeah. Although I would say, and I don't think this is the same thing as Dowdy in that term, but I can remember in the 80s when I was challenged to, like, why would you see the Dead three times in a row? Well, they play a different set list every night, and they jam was usually like point number two or three. And people knew what I meant. I meant that they didn't just recite the songs as per the album. They actually embodied them. I don't like the term jam any more than most people here probably do. But there's a simple kind of non-official sense in which a band that jams was a meaningful concept at the time.
But a band that jams does not have the same kind of stigma that the term jam band now
yeah.
has.
Right. Right. Yeah, sure.
But that stigma applies to the Grateful Dead from people who don't know any better. I was just talking to a fellow teacher. We were talking about musical taste, and I mentioned it was, someone presenting on the Grateful Dead at this conference. Do you like them? And I said, no, I don't like jam bands. And I think that, if it's fair to love, I'm not going to name them, but, certain bands in as jam bands, I don't count the Grateful Dead as part of it. I'm not saying necessarily is or that I do, but it's very distinct.
Okay, we've got Chris, and then we've got a gentleman in the back corner, and then Barry, if you don't mind. Chris, go ahead.
A lot of my introduction to my dissertation discusses this problem of the jam band, and this word that jam band, is it hyphenated? Is to get, and there's all these problems associated. And I sort of came to the conclusion where it's not so much the bands as it is the culture that surrounds the bands, maybe. It is a messy term. Like, do we define the music as jam band music? But included in that is new grass. A lot of the jam band scene kind of, slips over into the new grass, movement, the bluegrass, and slips over into this, and it's kind of a very slippery, blurry sort of image or word.
But you're focusing on the audience constructing.
Yes, I think the audience constructs it.
Well, the whatever the category, Dean Budnick created it and wrote the book that was a collection of all these bands, but the bands have been struggling to get out from under that punishing label ever since.
Right.
And it's almost meaningless because the different kinds of music that fall under that, and then there's, of course, the tragic absence of actual jamming in some of
yes.
music. But that's for another.
Yes, back here, please.
Yeah, Liz, you made some comment, in part of your talk about somebody making an analogy between the Deadheads in the 60s, where they had Vietnam and all we have is the broken car. Well, I don't really remember Vietnam being part of going to any shows or not.
He makes reference, he says, I don't know what a hippie was.
Right.
And then he says something else, and he says, it's more, he's not making a, I don't think he, I don't know Benji. I don't think the point of the quote is to make a direct comparison
right.
between.
No, but the car thing. I mean, I can remember when I was in high school, getting ready to go to the Newport Folk Festival in the summer, and that was like the biggest event of the year. And it was like getting together with your friends and planning the trip and getting the car and getting there. And I'm not sure if that's kind of what's going on with. Well, it was Newport, and then the Dead, and then the jam bands is part of a kind of a cultural continuum, and it has something to do with, it seems like the car, it was never really possible before our kind of car culture took over in the 60s, where young kids had cars and could actually go to shows from different parts of the country. Everybody could go and come to one place, that's sort of.
No, that's interesting because I've always just thought of it as kind of the, I don't want to say the Gen X thing, I don't have a better word for it now, but kind of the we don't, you know, a lot of people in the late 90s, you know, we don't have any of those great war stories. We don't, you know, there was nothing that we were rebelling against. There was this sense of, you know, everybody in the 60s and the 70s had Vietnam. You had this, you know, politics going on. Everybody was a part of something, and this sort of apathy feeling in the late 1990s. That's what I've read out of it, but the car culture is actually really interesting, so thank you for bringing that up.
Barry?
I don't have a question other than kudos to both Chris and Liz for just as last year when you electrified us, look what's happened again. Thanks for that. And the way both of you put this into a larger context, like the good scholars that you are, amen. I also wanted to put in a plug. If you're digging what we're talking about right now, tomorrow evening, I'm saying this because it's at a very inconvenient time and people I know are going to probably blow us off and want to go to dinner, but we have a killer panel at 6 o'clock tomorrow, 6 to 7:30, a nightmare of scheduling. It's called Hip, Cool, and the Cultural Currency of the Dead. It's I'll be moderating it. Jake Cohen, Kristen Crumlish, and Jesse Jarno will be talking about all of this and more. We will be calling into question the term jam band, questioning the existence of a jam band scene, which could be looked at as an artificial construct. And it's going to be, I think it's going to be a really great session to attend, and we're very worried nobody's going to come to it because they're going to want help.
Well, Barry, that seems like a perfect way to wind this down and end this session, so we can be prepared for our 2:15 session.
What Chris have put forth here is going to is perfect.
You're here.
Our next panel is at 2:15.